Okay, so as all of you may remember, so last time we started with a quick introduction and general outline of the course, just to give you to whet your appetite a little bit on what sort of this is all about and what the overall goal will be by the end of this semester. As I said, essentially the overarching goal will be to give you a introduction into the numerical methods that underlie essentially most of modern hydrodynamics codes that are applied everywhere, essentially across physics and engineering, but especially also in astrophysics and cosmology. So essentially all the methods you'll learn here and some of the mathematical foundation that we are going to go through should be useful, not just for astrophysics, but sort of for a much broader range of problems and research fields. Last time in the second part, we actually started to sort of with our first chapter with a basic introduction to partial differential equations. So I don't know how much all of you have sort of worked with partial differential equations yet. Some of you definitely have, some others may not. So I just wanted to make sure that we start on the same page and we set essentially the foundation for a few things that will come. So this first chapter will be sort of more sort of mathematical in nature and will be mostly definitions, essentially, just to set the groundwork for basic definitions and terms that we are going to use later on. And so last time we discussed second order partial differential equations, and we'll discuss also numerical methods for this later on in the course. For now, let's turn to first order partial differential equations. So this will be section 1.2. Excuse me for a second, I need to switch screens here. So this will be a basic introduction to first order partial differential equations.
Daniel, we're again seeing
Yes. The
weird split screen.
The weird split screen.
Yeah, just like a form, like half of the screen type thing.
Yeah, I see. It's the same. It's essentially the same problem again.
There we go.
Is it better now?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Okay. Perfect. Thank you. Yeah, and if you notice anything, just as Ramiro just did, just jump in and let me know. Also, if you have questions, just feel free to interrupt me anytime, and I'm more than happy to discuss at any point a few things in more detail. So the first thing I wanted to start with is just again with a classification of the different types of first order partial differential equations that we know of, and this will be very analogous to the second order case that we dealt with last time. So again, I'm using here just for notation, again, x is some point in Rn, and so omega 1 and omega 2 will be, some subsets therein. And so L is going to denote our differential operator, so that essentially maps one function that operates on this one subset omega n to another function that lives in this other function space. So some function will be mapped onto L u. And so you can think of these, for example, as like all functions that are twice differentiable, continuously differentiable, for example. And here we, for example, have sort of all continuous functions. And omega and omega 2 can obviously be Rn itself. So that is just to remind everyone of the notation from last time. And so obviously the broadest class of first order PDEs are the nonlinear partial differential equations, where this differential operator is just some general function of space X. It may depend on the solution U itself, and it may depend on obviously the first derivatives. Again, this notation here is just to denote the partial derivative with respect to the ith coordinate direction. So it's the same as partial u partial xi. And so this is, and one general example of this category is the following. So for example, we take the partial derivative in x1 direction, and then we subtract the square of the partial derivative in the x2 direction. And that's obviously a nonlinear first order partial differential equation. Now the second class, and this is something we will actually deal with quite often, is this class of quasi-linear partial differential first order partial differential equations. So here, the operator takes on the following form. So we have some coefficients in front of the first order partial differential, the partial derivatives, and those coefficients may depend on space and also on the solution, but they may not depend on the derivatives themselves. So this makes them quasi-linear. And then we may have some what we call source term that may depend on space, but also on the solution. One basic example, and this is one something that we'll discuss a lot in the course, is the following, the inviscid Burgers equation. So where we have this combination of partial derivatives. And, or so if I write it out in this sort of more usual notation. And this is known as the inviscid Burgers equation. And this is actually one of the model equations for hydrodynamics, where we're going to explore some numerical methods later on. So this is why this is a nice model equation to look at. So then the third category I wanted to briefly introduce are the semi-linear equations. And here the operator takes on the following form. So again, this is adding more simplifications. Now the coefficients of the first order partial derivatives only depend on space. They don't depend on the solution itself. While the source term is still of the same type as for the quasi-linear equations. So one example is this trivial example here, where we just set the first partial derivative equal to the solution U itself. And finally, the linear equations are of the following form. Where now these coefficients may still depend on space, but the source terms may not depend on the solution anymore. So they only depend on space. And here's another example and model equation that we're going to discuss a lot, which is the linear advection equation. And the reason why this is called an advection equation will become obvious in a few minutes, maybe 20 minutes from now. We'll discuss some properties of this equation a little more in this lecture. So this is the linear advection equation. Another important model equation for numerical methods as well. Now it turns out that in hydrodynamics, we're mostly interested actually in systems of equations. So not just a single scalar equation, but we're actually mostly interested in systems of first order partial differential equations. And in particular, we are interested in so-called hyperbolic systems of first order equations. And so let me therefore start and define what we mean by a system of hyperbolic first order equations. How those equations will arise physically is something that we'll discuss in the next chapter when we discuss the equations of hydrodynamics and radiation transport and so on and so forth. So here it's just a sort of abstract mathematical definition, but we'll discuss a lot more how such systems actually, such equations actually arise in physics later on. So now we are talking about a vector of sort of functions or vector valued functions. So let's say we have a tuple of functions and those depend both on space and time. So they take some time coordinate from some interval in R and they take some spatial point in Rn and they map to Rm. And let's say that we have two vectors in Rn and a collection of matrices that depend on space and time, and they may depend on this vector of functions U. Those are M by M matrices. And I goes from 1 to n, so labels the number of dimensions of our sort of real space Rn. And now let's consider a linear combination of these matrices that where xi is sort of defines this linear combination. So the components of this vector xi are just the coefficients of this linear combination of matrices. So now comes the actual definition. So the quasi-linear system of this form and then we may have some source terms here where capital B now indicates that we're sort of thinking here in terms of vectors. So this is a vector equation. So I label this with a star because I'll need to refer to this in just a second. And so we call this, so equations of this type, so you see this is a first order equation. It exactly looks like the one that we just discussed in the first definition. And now we just have a vector version of it here. And so we call this system of equations hyperbolic if this linear combination of matrices is diagonalizable at any point x and for any linear combination of these matrices AI, and for all times t, and for all solutions, or say the state vectors, this is what we usually call them in our M. In particular, the system is hyperbolic . Please let me know if I move too fast here on these pages. It's hyperbolic if for all these vectors, so everywhere in space and for any linear combination and for all times, A has m real eigenvectors, so m real eigenvalues and complete set of eigenvectors. And so we'll denote them by lambda I to lambda m. And so we can also label them. So we can also like arrange them according to their value. So there's some order that and then we'll denote the corresponding eigenvectors by R. The eigenvectors are I. They also depend on space, time, the solution, so the state vector, and the particular linear combination that we look at. And so those form a basis of Rm. So this is the basic definition. So we just require this linear combination of matrices here, these sort of advection matrices, to have m real eigenvalues. Therefore a set of eigenvectors that form a complete space basis of Rm. There are two special cases now that often appear. So I wanted to write this down explicitly as well. And so this is the term of symmetric hyperbolicity and strictly. Hyperbolicity. So the first one is the case in which all these matrices AI are symmetric. So in some cases, they may happen to be symmetric. And so then, obviously, any linear combination is symmetric. And then sort of by basic linear algebra, you may all remember that they are then diagonalizable. And so this is what we call, in this case, we call the system of quasi-linear PDEs here, symmetric hyperbolic. We call star is symmetric hyperbolic. And then the second special case is where any linear combination of these matrices has M real, but also distinct eigenvalues. So that we can actually order them in the following way. So we have strict inequalities here and so on. And then again, strict inequality to lambda m. And if this again holds for all, you know, everywhere in space, everywhere in time, for any linear combination, we call the system strictly hyperbolic. So first of all, A is diagonalizable. And we call the system strictly hyperbolic. And this will play an important role essentially for all the numerical methods that we're going to design to solve these equations. So we will directly make use of some of these analytic properties of the equations. Now, just to give you two really quick examples. Yes? Mm-hmm.
So why is it necessary for it to be like everywhere in space and time? Can't you say locally? Because almost all the well-posedness results that you have are local, and calling a like equation globally strictly hyperbolic, what's the thing there?
Yeah, you're totally right. I could have done this just locally here. I just asked this to be globally here for simplicity, because we will actually not need to relax it in the way that you described. But you're totally right. In principle, we can just write down the same definition, and we just ask this locally, this property, and then from these local properties, we can also work with this local property in some cases. But essentially, in most cases, for most applications that we will deal with here, we will just need sort of this global strictly hyperbolicity requirement.
Can I ask a question as well? So if we were dealing with a system of elliptic equations, what would change in the definition?
Yes. If we're dealing with elliptic equations, then those are these systems where none of the eigenvalues are actually real. So it could turn out that for some systems, so we can look at the same system essentially, and if it turns out that the eigenvalues of these matrices AI, none of those are actually real, then this is what we would call an elliptic system.
Okay, interesting. I never saw it presented like this before, so.
Yes. So thanks for the remark. So we can write this down in a second. I just wanted to very basic terms. You can think of just a system like this. And so you can almost see it just from this equation that this is actually a strictly hyperbolic system. If you don't see it right now, so you can actually work it out. Just compute the eigenvalues of that matrix. This is super easy. And sort of just to illustrate symmetric hyperbolicity, we can just modify this matrix just a little bit, and then this system here. Turns out to be symmetric hyperbolic. So here you see the matrix is symmetric. Okay, so yeah, let's actually write down two remarks. Take Eric's point and note that the system star is elliptic, if none of the eigenvalues is real. And the second remark I just wanted to write down is that last time we discussed how these terms elliptic and hyperbolic and parabolic come about for second order partial differential equations. So we briefly discussed the geometric interpretation behind this. And so I just wanted here to make this note and this connection to what we discussed last time, namely the reason why we call this hyperbolic is, or say one reason why one could sort of motivate this term is because it turns out that any second order hyperbolic PDE can be sort of recast as a system of first order hyperbolic equations. And so this property that that second order hyperbolic PDEs result in systems of first order hyperbolic PDEs is what essentially gives these systems their name. So second order hyperbolic can be recast as systems of first order hyperbolic PDEs. And so this will actually be an exercise on one of the first homework problem sets. So I will not sort of go into more detail here, but rather move on. And that brings me to the sort of next definition. So I apologize. This is rather sort of boring in terms of definitions here, but we have to sort of lay out some terms here to work with. And so this is why we're going to go from definition to definition. And now that we know what first order hyperbolic systems of PDEs are, let's define what we mean by conservation laws. So conservation laws, and this will be sort of the type of equations that we will be dealing with everywhere in hydrodynamics. And it turns out that I will show in the second chapter in the following weeks that even non-conservation laws, completely other types of equations, like the equation of radiative transfer, can be recast as conservation equations under certain conditions, if we make some approximations to this. And so in the end, in computational hydrodynamics, it always comes back to conservation laws. And this is really also where all the numerical methods are designed around. They are really crafted around conservation laws. So these are systems of the following form. So first order partial differential equations that can be written in the following form. And so here we have what we call the fluxes. So again, this is sort of a shorthand notation for this expression. So this is the divergence of flux, of this sort of flux vector. And on the right-hand side, we may have what we call a source term. So this is this term B, capital B, in the previous definition, essentially. Now just sort of shuffle to the right-hand side. And so again, U is a vector of functions U1 to UM. And this is what we call conserved variables. And as I already mentioned, Fi of U, which is essentially a vector of flux vectors, actually, where I runs from 1 to n through all the spatial dimensions. This is the vector of fluxes. Okay, and then just to be very precise, these are the source terms or sources. Okay. And so finally, we also need to define the Jacobians of these flux functions. This is what will give rise essentially to advection equations, or advection type equations, flux functions Fi of u. And now you can see how I adapt the notation to the previous definition. I call this Ai of u, and so here we have essentially all the gradients listed. So this is partial fmi with respect to u1 and partial fmi with respect to um. So also just to be very picky, if the source terms are non-zero instead of conservation law, this is then called a balance law. For reasons that I'll mention in a second, just to have this term introduced as well. And this brings me to two remarks. We can actually write these systems of conservation laws as systems of quasi-linear PDEs, according sort of in the sense of the previous definition, by using these expressions of the Jacobians. So conservation laws, and I will just abbreviate them by CL because otherwise it's a lot to write in the following. So conservation laws are CLs. Can be written as a system of quasi-linear PDEs of first order by applying the chain rule and using the expression for the Jacobians. By applying the chain rule. So the divergence of these flux functions can be written as partial fi by partial u, and then we have to differentiate u with respect to xi. But this is just the Jacobians of the flux functions times the partial derivative of the vector u. And so we can exactly write these conservation laws as first order system of quasi-linear PDEs. And so the second note, just in very general, I wanted to make is that the source terms S, they can arise due to several things. So first, there are physical reasons why such source terms can arise. They would sort of account for physical sources or sinks. Of otherwise conserved quantities. I'll discuss this aspect in a second in a little more detail. But they can also arise sort of through changes of coordinates, for example. in which case we call them geometric source terms. And in particular, such geometric source terms arise in relativistic hydrodynamics, in general relativistic hydrodynamics, where space-time quantities actually appear on the right-hand side of the hydrodynamic equations that would otherwise have zero source terms. So this is what we call geometric source terms. But even if you look at sort of Newtonian hydrodynamics and you rewrite this from Cartesian coordinates to spherical polar coordinates or so, you actually end up picking up sort of geometric source terms. So, and the third remark I wanted to make is again the what I already alluded to, why these systems of equations are actually called conservation laws. So for this, let's consider the integral form of the equations. And compute the following expression. And let's integrate this vector of conserved variables over some control volume. Then we need to integrate also over the flux terms, the divergence of these flux terms. And so V is some control volume. And here we've just like pulled out the partial derivative with respect to time in front of the integral. And so we can use the divergence theorem and write this as a integral over the surface of this control volume, this flux function projected onto the unit normal on the surface. So this is the unit normal. Pointing outward. On the surface of this control volume V. And so this means essentially, you know, the sort of time rate change of U, this vector of conserved variables inside this control volume V depends only on the total flux through the surface. So we say that U is conserved. And this is essentially the motivation for the naming of these types of equations. And there are also immediately sort of a few very simple examples that will be of relevance here. Namely, for example, let's take the two equations that we already discussed, namely the Invissit-Burgers equation and the advection equation. And you'll see that we can immediately write them down actually as conservation laws. So in order for, so now again, this is not a system. Now we're just looking at the scalar equation just as a quick example. So this would be the prototype form of a scalar conservation law. And so if we choose the flux function to be constant, A times the solution U, we actually obtain the linear advection equation. Okay, and the other sort of simple choice we could make is, let's say we specify a flux function fu equals 1/2 u squared. That means that df by du is u times ux. And so this is exactly the Invissit-Burgers equation that we discussed above. Oh, sorry, this is, should be ux here. Okay, do we have any questions at this point? I think so far it's all just very basic definitions. And so on the first problem set, which I'll post on Thursday, there'll be some easy sort of examples to get familiar with these definitions and to look into some interesting examples. If not, then let's just move on to essentially the next subsection.
Can I ask something before? Yeah, sorry.
Sure, of course.
So I guess in order to write equations in this like conservative form, you need to have the right variables of your physical system, right? So, I mean, you have to, for example, I don't know, maybe in a fluid, what you would, these variables would be momentum or something like that. Of the yes. fluid or something in some certain directions. So I was thinking, like, can any system that we find interesting in physics, that it's like hyperbolic in the sense of the equations, can be written in like a conservative form if you find the right variables?
That's a good comment. So in general, no. So it depends on the physical system that you're looking at. And it turns out that you can write the hydrodynamics equations in a non-conservative form, and you can write them, for example, in a conservative form. And so it turns out that that is a crucial point when designing numerical schemes, because as we'll discuss in probably a few weeks from now, there are sort of very special properties of conservation laws, and we will make use of those properties, and those will be important to get the correct solution, actually. So it's actually hard to design numerical schemes that converge to the correct solution if they're not written in conservative form. So this distinction between non-conservative and conservative form is of crucial importance. And so that's a really good point that you're raising. But I cannot say a lot more about this right now, because we simply don't have all the groundwork done yet. But we'll get there in a few weeks from now. That's a really good point. Mm-hmm. Okay, so then let's discuss some properties. I wanted to point out some properties of these first order hyperbolic systems, and they will also be of importance later on. And this includes concepts like characteristics, domain of dependence, domain of determinancy, and range of influence. And they will also be important for designing numerical schemes. Because we have to be, it turns out, we have to be very mindful of these sort of properties of the on the analytic level when designing numerical schemes. So let me first discuss characteristics. And so let's look first at linear systems. So again, remember, for linear hyperbolic systems, these coefficient matrices, they are just constants. They don't depend on the solution. And in particular, They only depend on space, but we'll here assume that they only, that are essentially just constants, that they don't depend on space. So this is sort of the simplest system one can look at. So this is UT plus some matrix, and we'll also just focus on one spatial dimension here. So we won't have a sum here over all the different spatial dimensions. We'll just assume n is one. We only have one spatial dimension, and let's assume that A has constant coefficients. And then hyperbolicity implies that there's some matrix Q that diagonalizes our matrix A, so that we can write A as Q lambda Q inverse, where lambda is just this diagonal matrix with all the, carries all the eigenvalues, the M real eigenvalues on the diagonal. So these are the eigenvalues of A. And you probably all remember from basic linear algebra that this matrix can be just obtained by just taking all the eigenvectors of A and then just writing them as column vectors. So this is how you get how you explicitly get this matrix Q. Now, we can actually make use of this and write our system as UT plus Q lambda Q to the minus one UX equals zero. And we can multiply by Q inverse and define what we call new variables, so-called characteristic variables. So let's define a new state vector V by Q inverse multiplying U. And this is what we call characteristic variables. And then we can just write this system of equations in the following form. And now sort of our advection matrix here is lambda in these new coordinates. And since lambda is a diagonal matrix, all these equations have decoupled now. So we have just a list of independent advection equations. So this is a decoupled system. Now let's define characteristics. So characteristics are curves, and I'll denote them by gamma of t, where t is just some parameterizing that curve, along which the partial differential equations, or the partial differential equation, becomes an ODE. And to see how this actually works, let's look at the following sort of construction. Now let's say sort of gamma of t parameterizes some points in space x. And let's look at some functions vi along this curve. So where I plug in this curve as 0.x in space. Now let's see what the total time derivative of this function is. And you'll see that this looks like our conservation law. So this is gamma prime of t. The x, so if we choose gamma prime to be one of these eigenvalues, lambda I, which we call characteristic speeds. You see that according to the conservation law that we've written down above, to the hyperbolic system we've written down above, that actually dEvi with respect to t actually vanishes zero. So these functions vi are constant along characteristics. So therefore, if say, this means that if we just follow along a characteristic, that function will stay constant. So we can actually construct the solution by just following back a characteristic to where it originated from. And this is the idea here. So we can just look at t equals zero, which I'll just denote by vi exponent zero of x, which is essentially the initial data that we start with at time zero. And now we can obtain vi of x comma t, where this is just our characteristic. Gamma t that passes through x at t. So I'll try to actually sketch this in a second. So essentially this means, just to write this down explicitly, that vi at x of t, x and t, is entirely determined by initial data vi zero at x zero. So this means that essentially the partial differential equation will just translate this initial profile according to this characteristic speed and just propagate it in time. So this is why we call it an advection equation. And I'll try to draw this here. Let me see. So I'm going to say we have this initial profile Okay, so this would be our initial profile, vi 0 of x. And now let's try to also draw here a second axis, namely time. And then essentially what these type of equations would do is translate this profile in time. So this would be the characteristic curve x0 plus lambda it, where so this would be the corresponding x0. Okay. And by just following these this sort of flow of characteristics, we can immediately compute the profile of this function at some data time x and t. So what we see here is just the advection of vi0 with speed lambda I, with this ith eigenvalue of this matrix A. So what we have up here is in these characteristic coordinates here, we just have a decoupled system of n such advection equations. And in every spatial dimension, we're just advecting whatever initial profile we have. Okay. And this essentially brings me just to summarize how you would sort of go about solving such a system in general. Such a system of linear PDEs. So the general initial value problem will be solved in the following way, namely just by using this construction of characteristics. So let's say we have such a system of equations, and we have given some initial data at t equals 0. Let's refer to this as step one. Then we introduce characteristic variables. That we call V, and we get them by taking Q inverse times our state vector U. So this leads us to the system Vt plus lambda Vx equals zero. And accordingly, we have some initial data for this. Okay. Now we can construct V at some later time through this characteristic construction. So we obtain Vi at some later time t by following the corresponding characteristic with speed lambda I. And then we transform back to get u at some later time. And now you can see that this is also a useful expression we can just write this as vi xt times the right eigen vector ri. So remember that the column vectors of Q are these eigenvectors of A. And so again, substituting, following this back to t equals zero, we can write this as vi zero of x minus lambda I t ri. And so this is the general solution to one. So as you can see, the general solution here can be written as a superposition of these eigenvectors. I.e., these are really waves propagating at finite speeds. And this is actually something that also will appear on the first problem set. Because another sort of approach to hyperbolicity in hyperbolic systems is to demand that they should give rise to m independent wave solutions. And you can then show that this leads to the definition of hyperbolicity. So this is just another motivation, and this is something you'll see on the appearing on the first problem sheet. And so this is interesting, and this is important because that tells us that information is propagating at finite speeds according to these equations. And just to summarize again what I already said, it's entirely determined by initial data. X naught I equals X minus lambda IT. So we'll get back to this in a second, to sort of information propagating at finite speed and so on. I just wanted to point out that if we now go to systems of conservation laws, instead of essentially just these advection equations, we'll have the following situation. So let's have some conservation law of the following form. We again only retain one spatial dimension. Then also here we can transform them with the help of sort of characteristic variables, but only locally in general, because now the corresponding Jacobians actually depend on space and may depend on the solution themselves. So there's no global transformation into characteristic variables that we can do, but at least we can do it sort of locally. So we can locally transform into a decoupled system. So hyperbolicity implies that, again, we have some matrix Q, which is non-constant in general. And again, this matrix A should denote the Jacobians of the flux function. And so we can express this Jacobian as Q lambda Q minus one, where again, lambda is a diagonal matrix. with all the eigenvalues on the diagonal of this from this Jacobian. And so this is possibly only locally. So locally, we can write this as something like above in this characteristic variables V, but the meaning of V here depends on the solution itself, so it depends on U. And so obviously lambda
characteristics depend on the state vector U. And so this is what usually people call that the state or the solution is self-propagating. And this is essentially all that I wanted to say here. I just wanted to sort of introduce this terminology because you'll find that everywhere in the literature. And this essentially just means that we can only locally sort of resort to characteristic variables. Okay, any questions so far?
Yeah, I have a general question. So in the local case like this, I can see that, well, this is a straightforward generalization of what you did for the constant, you know, constant matrix case. And everything follows more or less in the same way, but you know, that is not a very practical thing to do, right? I mean, do you present this on a conceptual level or do you present this as a method that could be pursued in practical calculations?
Yeah, no, I'm just presenting this on the conceptual level. Mm-hmm. So once we actually discuss sort of numerical methods and how to solve these equations, then we'll do this in a very different way. But this was just to introduce essentially these concepts of sort of characteristic variables and characteristics. We will make use of some of these definitions, but we will not actually follow any of these approaches to solve the equation.
Okay, thanks. That clarifies.
Sure. Yeah, thanks. Any other questions? If not, I will just in the last few minutes introduce the last concept I wanted to talk about, which is the domain of dependence and range of influence. Okay, so this is just another definition in this long series of definitions. So the domain of dependence, and we'll denote this by D, is the domain of the initial data zero of X that entirely determines the solution at some later time T. For hyperbolic system Okay. And so we already discussed this, the fact that sort of information is propagating at finite speed. And one can actually show that there's the following theorem. I'm not going to prove it here because so the proof is actually involved. I can point you to actually where to look it up, but intuitively it is actually easy to understand sort of what's being said here. Namely, the statement is the following. So let U be solution of the symmetric hyperbolic system. And I try to summarize this in a second in a sketch, actually. So again, we have this system of symmetric hyperbolic system. And let's say that these are constant coefficients to make it simple. And then let's say, consider some point x naught t naught. Well, let me try to draw this here. So this will be x and t, and let's consider some point in space and time in sort of the evolution of the system from some initial data at t equals zero. And let's say, okay, so here we have t zero, and you have x zero. And now let's define another time t1. And the following sets B. And so those are all points x for which x minus x naught smaller than m times t0, where m is actually the maximum signal speed. I'll just write this down in a second. So let's see, say this, and then define another set of points. T0 minus T1. So let me indicate these. Let me just first write down what M is. So M is just the maximum of all lambda I, where again, lambda I are the eigenvalues of this, of any linear combination of these matrices AI. So then let's say this is our set B. So we're now just in one spatial dimension. So this would just be this interval here. And so this part here would be m times t naught. And let's say here is our time t1. Then this will be our interval or set C. And so essentially then the statement is that, and so this is the way that sort of mathematicians would write it down. If the solution to these equations U, if that is zero on B, then U also must be zero on C. So if it's sort of zero here, in this interval here, then the solution also must be zero up here, meaning that sort of nothing outside this interval actually influences
solution of the equations. And in particular, we see here that just taking the maximum of these signal speeds, of these characteristic speeds, gives us essentially the maximum velocity at which information can travel on sort of on in our domain XT, something that we already saw up here, essentially. So in a case of constant coefficients, where we sort of wrote down the solution as a linear combination of eigenvectors with these finite characteristic speeds lambda I. And so this is essentially just a sort of different formulation of the same thing. Essentially this information can only propagate at finite speed. And so this is, let me just, summarize here two obvious things. So this domain, and this is, so B would be in this case the domain of determinancy of dependence here. So D is determined by the fastest and slowest characteristic speed. And this will be a useful property to design numerical schemes. So we'll make use of that. And I also wanted to say that in particular, since sort of D is determined by finite speeds, D is in particular bounded. So it cannot be just the whole sort of real axis, say in this example. So lambda I are finite by construction. And this boundedness also applies actually to nonlinear systems, which is important because this is the actual case that we are interested in mostly. So also for nonlinear system information propagates at finite speed. Okay, and just to close this, I know time is up, just one more minute. So if we have the 1D example, or say a 1D system, again, with constant coefficients, we've shown above that we can actually write this in the following form. And so the domain of dependence will just be a set of points here, namely just these corresponding x naught points. So x minus lambda I t, where I equals 1 to m. So we just go take the sort of different characteristic speeds, follow them backwards, and see where you hit t equals 0. And this will be essentially your domain of dependence in this case. Okay. Any final questions? Sorry for going a few minutes over time. Okay. No final questions. I guess everyone is tired at this point in time. It's been a long day.
So maybe I guess,
yeah.
Eric,
go ahead.
Oh, so you gave these mathematical way of saying, oh, okay, if the solution is zero on B, then should be zero on C2. Is there like a stronger claim of the sort you can make? Like something that is not zero, you can say something about the solution on B. I'm just wondering if there's just like something else you could say, or that's like the strongest thing you can say with, I don't know.
Yeah, that's a good question. So as far as I'm aware, I'm not 100% familiar with all the mathematical literature, but as far as I know, this is sort of the strongest statement you can make, at least for these systems, and essentially that captures the essence. Now, to prove this for nonlinear systems, so this would be the obvious sort of the obvious generalization of this. That is much harder to prove. So this proof, if you're interested, I can point you to that. This proof is still fairly simple. It is a little more involved, and it uses a few techniques that we cannot discuss here. But going to the nonlinear cases, this becomes harder. If you really want to have a mathematical proof of that, but you can do it. So the statement is yes. For nonlinear systems, boundedness applies, and there's a bounded sort of domain of dependence for these type of systems.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the question I had is, so in the example you just showed, then the domain of dependence is a discrete set. So you've got three characteristic speeds, and therefore you have three points on the axis from which the information can originate.
Yes.
I guess as soon as you go away from that special case, then the entire space fills up and you've got sort of a maximum speed, but pretty much all the speeds up to that maximum. So the domain of dependence would just fill up and become the entire, I don't want to say the entire line, but the line bounded by the maximum speed.
Yes, exactly. That's correct. So if you go to systems of equations and then to the nonlinear case, you will actually get continuous intervals for these domains of dependence. So only in this very special case with a linear system with constant coefficients, you actually get a discrete set of points. But so if you generalize this to the nonlinear case, then you will actually get entire intervals.
Yeah. Right. So is it the nonlinearity or the non-constant coefficients that give you the non-discrete nature of the domain?
Yeah, it's both. I think it's both.
It's both. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Thanks.
Okay. Any more questions or comments? Okay. If not, then. Thanks a lot. Sorry for going a few minutes over time, and see you all on Thursday.